Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, thank you for checking out the Performance Anxiety Podcast on the Pantheon Podcast Network. As always, I am your host, Mark, and I am thrilled to welcome Kare Calloway and Joe Cardamone, a.k.a. Queen Kwong and Skeleton Joe, to the podcast. Kare talks about growing up in a hotel and her dad's industrial/punk nightclub in Denver. Once she started focusing on music, this would be after her 6th grade band Population 3, one of her first gigs was opening for Nine Inch Nails and, as she describes it, messing up on a large scale. She's also written music with them that's never even come out. But she really started finding her voice after meeting Joe Cardamone from the Icarus line. With Joe's help, Kare has developed a unique improvisational style of recording albums. In fact, their maxim is, the first take may not be the best sounding, but it's the most honest. So they try to stick to that whenever possible. It's worked for her albums as well as the Quarantina film project she and Joe collaborated on over the pandemic. Kare also discusses her late diagnosis of cystic fibrosis and how that has affected her. She's got a new album out soon called Couples Only, and she tells me why she used that name and how much of the record is about reclaiming her voice after a pretty rough divorce. Follow her at Queen Kwong on social media, follow Joe at Joe_Cardamone, and pick up the new album Couples Only, wherever you get music. Follow us at Performance ANX. Support the show with a review or money. Merch is available through performanceanx.threadless.com. You can buy us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/performanceanxiety. Now check out Queen Kwong and Skeleton Joe on Performance Anxiety, part of the Pantheon Podcast Network.
Okay, so the podcast, even it's performance, or I mean, it's a
performance anxiety.
Performance anxiety, right? This is Kare from Queen Kwong on Performance Anxiety. I forgot to mention the record, but I'm not sure how to fit that in.
I think you just did. That'll work.
Okay.
Nailed it.
You okay, don't cool. want to hear us talk more than that. It gets bleak fast.
Oh, well, Joe's been on before, so we did it like an hour last time, I think. So,
yep, I'm a motor mouth.
But we don't have to go too deep into Joe's past because we've already done that. So,
been there, done that.
Yeah, exactly.
One take wonder.
Exactly. Yeah. I heard that. That's basically how you do your records.
Yes. Yeah.
So I definitely want to get into that. But before we get into too much, I want to find out a little bit about how you got into music in the first place. Was there a lot of it when you were growing up? Was there a lot in the house? Were you playing instruments, taking lessons?
Well, like every good Asian, I was forced to take piano lessons from a young age. It didn't stick though very well. So I think I took classical piano from the age of 4 to, I don't know, a few years. But other than that, I'm self-taught, and I grew up in a little bit of an unusual situation. I grew up in a hotel mostly, and
wow.
My dad owned a infamous kind of punk and industrial nightclub in Denver. And so that was around for like 20 years. So I grew up there too. And wow. I was exposed to a lot of music from an early age and a music scene of sorts.
Okay.
From a really early age. But my parents themselves aren't very musical. I kind of found my own way to playing music.
When did that happen? When did you really get the bug to go out and start playing in front of people?
Well, I was started writing lyrics at a really early age. I think I just made up melodies and songs and poems. And so I got really into writing lyrics. And then my first memory of wanting to be a performer, or I had a band, quote unquote band, in the sixth grade with two other girls who I just kind of forced into it. And
what was it called?
Population 3.
Ah, nice.
I actually have a recording of that. Was the first recorded song we did. It's pretty funny. My music teacher, who was kind of a creep, took an interest in me, and he programmed the music and we recorded it with him.
Oh, wow.
And I still have the recording. So that was in the sixth grade, but that was before I played guitar. But from there, from that music teacher, and I guess, yeah, it's pretty much him. Hate to credit him too much, but he got me into playing guitar, and I think he gave me a guitar to use. And I got into, into teaching myself guitar, and was doing the singer-songwriter thing when I was a preteen. And then in high school, I was in a little kind of punk rock band. And that's how it all began.
So as you're doing this and getting more confidence, you end up opening for Nine Inch Nails. How did that whole connection happen? How did you meet Trent and get an opening slot on on his tour?
So I've opened for Trent a few times over the years. It seems like it's kind of cyclical, but I was supposed to go to college in New York City, and I had graduated about a year and a half early from high school, and I was driving towards the East Coast and spent some time in New Orleans, stopped there. And by chance, like, I knew he had a studio down there. I wasn't a huge Nine Inch Nails fan per se, but I'm trying to remember who I ran into first, but basically I met one of the guys who worked for him. Okay. And I talked a big game, and I don't know exactly what I said. I was a really kind of crazy kid, but I got myself into the studio, and he was there with Alan Mulder and Atticus Ross. And they put me on the spot, really, and they're just like, okay, well, play us something. And I played them something, and Trent recorded three demos with me that night.
Oh, wow.
And said he was relocating to Los Angeles the next month, and said I should do the same. And I did. And then from there, he just asked me to open for him. I guess I did the With Teeth tour. And then a few years later, I opened Wave Goodbye. And then a few years ago, I also opened for him in Vegas. So it's kind of just been a weird thing.
A weird recurring connection.
I don't try to find meaning in it. I don't subscribe to the belief that everything happens for a reason. It's just one of those weird things.
So how did, what kind of a reaction did you get? So you're opening for Nine Inch Nails, but it just you up there with the guitar?
Yeah. I mean, when I was a teenager, the first time it was just me and a guitar.
Wow.
It was really terrible.
Oh no.
Really, really, really terrible. Extraordinarily terrible. And yeah, I don't know. It was kind of his fans are pretty extreme. Whenever you're a support band for most bands, especially bigger bands, people are not there to see you, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So, but his fans are very extreme. They don't want to see anybody but him. And it was, the first time I opened, they were the first shows. And after, I think he took a hiatus, like just several years off or something. And I was the first person they saw, and they were not thrilled.
Oh,
and
wow.
I wasn't thrilled either. There was just a lot of shit thrown at me.
God.
And it was pretty weird. But I think after that experience, I wasn't really afraid of anything.
Well, that'll do
in
it.
Terms of performance, you know, performing, or, you know, I started out my career kind of really messing up on a very large scale in front of a lot of people. So
did you have much?
You
didn't have much live experience before that though, did you?
I mean, I played with my high school band and at in front of friends. And I played some coffee shops, you know, some open mic nights in Denver.
So coffee shops in Denver to Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, it was pretty weird.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Without a healthy mind, being truly happy and at peace is hard. The good news is therapy works. But what is therapy exactly? It's whatever you want it to be. Maybe you're not feeling motivated right now and would like some tools to help. Or maybe you're feeling insecure in relationships or at work, not dealing well with the stress. Whatever you need, it's time to stop being ashamed of normal human struggles and start feeling better because you deserve to be happy. And now you don't have to worry about finding an in-person therapist near you to help. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Try doing that in person. So join the millions of people who are seeing what online therapy is really about. It's always a good time to invest in yourself because you are your greatest asset. And a special offer to Performance Anxiety listeners, you can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at betterhelp.com/performanceanxiety. That's betterhelp.com/performanceanxiety. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast. Well, fast forward a few years, you end up releasing an EP, Bad Lieutenant. Were the songs much different? I mean, did any of the songs that you had been playing on any of the Nine Inch Nails tours, did any of them evolve, become anything that you ended up recording out later?
No. Oh,
okay.
And I think I did, you know, I worked with Trent at a studio out here when I first moved out here. I was working with him on some music and I really didn't like it. And I'm not precious when it comes to holding on to material that I don't feel great about. So I don't even remember really what I played initially for those nail shows, but no, none of the stuff on my EP or any of the recordings afterwards were those songs.
Now I'm under the impression, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when you are going to record your albums, it's a lot of stream of consciousness, improvisational lyrics. Is the music similar that way or?
Yeah. So I love this because this is like the only time ever, the first and probably only time that Joe has to just listen to me talk about myself.
We'll bring Joe in a minute.
We could extend the Zoom. Now I wish it could be longer. No, actually Joe's a big part of this. I really struggled with recording for a long time because working with Trent and other pretty prominent producers at first, I hated recording and I really couldn't figure out a way to record anything and feel good about releasing it. So Joe, I'm not really sure how it first happened, but when we recorded Get a Witness, we started this creative process. It seems to be the only creative process that works for me. And I think I didn't realize how unusual it was until recently, really. But for Joe, it was, I think, he was totally comfortable with how I do things. So we're really compatible in this way where the creative process started being just an improvised thing where I'll go into Joe's studio and maybe he will start making a beat and I'll start playing guitar or maybe a bass line to it.
It could be anything to play a song, you know, it's just like whatever, something happens and it's
just
like
a starting point.
Next.
We'll just, yeah.
Okay.
So we just kind of build off of that and we improvise and go with whatever's happening.
This is the last.
and then I will freestyle.
If I have a song in like 2 hours, then we're like not doing that song. We're doing something else.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I think we pretty, and I know pretty fast, like if I'm not into something, I can't force myself to work on it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the immediacy and the of improvising like that is the only way I seem to be able to record. And Joe has no problem with it. He is really supportive.
It's pretty much how I record, you know?
So yeah.
I got busted at the party, the shoot this weekend. I walked into the room and Alexander, who I've recorded his band, is talking to the band we're doing the video for and bragging, or I don't know if it's bragging, but he's telling the guys that I wouldn't let him do a second take of vocals. He's like, you won't believe it, man. He won't let you do another take. It's it. That's one vocal you're done.
And honestly, that's what I appreciate, because I was so used to before that, it was just like doing so many takes and it was lifeless and absolutely a miserable experience to have to do so many takes. Yeah. And I think for me, is it the best sounding version of the song that could ever exist? No, the first version is maybe not the best sounding or most perfected, but it's definitely the most honest.
Yeah.
And, I think Joe and I appreciate that more, you know, above anything. It is the most honest take.
Well, the first time you're ever saying those words out loud into a mic. So you still mean them, you know, in the moment, which is,
it's like the most genuine, but it doesn't, it's not like you've spent a bunch, you know, it's in real time. So it's not like it's been completely thought out.
It's not polished, but that's not the point anyways.
So how did you two meet?
Italian guy and a Filipino walk into a bar.
A priest and a rabbi walk into a bar. I mean, we've been known each other for so long. We
just through friends, I think, really.
Okay.
Through mutual friends, really.
Or mutual enemies, I'm not sure.
Whatever. Yeah, just like, you know, it's a small world after all, you know. It was just like that kind
of
really, you know.
And after what's that?
We did not meet on Tinder.
No.
God, that is definitely not what happened. Don't put that out. I mean, Tinder didn't even exist. It was MySpace probably.
Yeah. No, none of that existed.
No, it was in real life through, I think, a mutual connection. And we very briefly dated, which seems very strange.
Fashioned, boring way.
It wasn't, it wasn't very boring, but it was something. But I think it was so long ago. I mean, we're just family at this point. I mean, we've known each other for like 17 years. It's kind of insane.
Wow. That's awesome. But that actually makes a lot more sense. It makes a lot more sense to me that the way you guys work together works for you because you've known each other for so long.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we also, we're really aligned in terms of what we appreciate about music and art. And I think a lot of the stuff we do isn't for everybody, but we get it. And so, and it's rare to find. So we've kept up that relationship.
Even more so aligned in what we don't appreciate about
music. That's true. That's true. Which is also rare to find these days. We definitely, hate the same stuff.
Relationship built on mutual hate.
Yes.
Excellent. All right. Well, I've gone back and I've listened to the albums and I can definitely hear the hear progression. Like on the first album, I got to say, I do like that Chris Isaak cover. Baby Did a Bad, Bad Thing. I wasn't expecting that when I looked at the tracks on that.
Great at covers, but the ones that I for some reason gravitate towards are kind of it you wouldn't think. But yeah, that was a fun song. I'm a huge Chris Isaak fan, so
Oh yeah. And then Love Me to Death. I mean, that, Joe, I can definitely hear your influence in that album more so than Get a Witness to my ears. It sounds more.
Wow, Joe doesn't want to hear that. I think he would disagree.
Really?
I don't know. Yeah, I wouldn't even know, to be honest, you know. That's interesting. Cool. Yeah.
Well, I think at that point, I think Joe had more of an influence actually on Get a Witness, to be honest. It was just the two of us. I mean, it was just the two of us really not knowing. And it was sonically very challenging. We were both figuring out a lot and we just did it. And then I put it out because I just needed to put something out, and it kind of drew a hard line in the sand in terms of being a pretty polarizing act. It's a polarizing record. It's hard to listen to. It's very stream of consciousness.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Hey guys, I want to talk to you about socks for a second. Why not? It's a music podcast. But I tried a pair of socks from Boldfoot and love them. I've only worn them once because my kids have stolen them. So in my household, that's the best endorsement I can give. And I guess it's fitting because the design I chose was jailbait. Wait, jailbird. The design I chose was jailbird. I might keep that in. The socks are 100% American made and 5% of all proceeds go to veteran charities. It makes sense seeing that Boldfoot is a family and veteran owned company. They have a huge variety of styles. So check out boldfoot.com and buy some of the best socks you've ever slapped on your feet. And help veterans while you're at it. That's boldfoot.com.
We weren't concerned so much sonically about, you know, things sonically. It was more just capturing the moment and putting it out.
Okay.
But I think Joe played a really, I mean, it was only the two of us on that record. I think you were even playing drums or something, and you're not a drummer.
I'm a fantastic drummer.
I mean, listen to the record and decide for yourself. But but you know, it worked for what I needed to do in the moment. And then I think Love Me to Death was a little more quote unquote polished. That's a stretch, but it was a little more put together than Get a Witness. And yeah, and then this one I think is a departure too. I think for both Joe and I, we always strive to challenge ourselves and not do the same thing over and over.
One of the questions that popped into my head as I'm listening to this and reading about how you do record in a stream of conscious manner, when you go and you play live, are the songs the same, or are you doing stream of conscious live?
No, I don't think anything is ever the same, and I never really play anything the same way twice. But if you hear Get a Witness, for instance, and then I play a lot of those songs live, actually, they've definitely evolved into something else, to the point where people would come up to me afterwards and say, geez, you should re-record Get a Witness with how you play it live or whatever. Because the thing is when you record like how we do, that's the first time, the recorded version is basically the first time we've ever played it. And then when you tour and you play the songs, you know, 50-100 times later, they evolve into, it's kind of the opposite of what other people do. Right. Other people will play a song for a really long time, learn it, figure out the kinks, let it evolve, and then record the record version of it, you know. But for me, it's the opposite. So everything is pretty different live and has evolved a lot, which I like, though. Like I don't like going to shows and hearing the band play what, you know, having them play exactly what it sounds like on the record. It's
right. Yeah.
What's the point?
Yeah. Me either. I love hearing that
thing. Might as well listen to the record, you know?
Yeah. Might as well just stay home, which I'd rather do anyway.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you about, and we can go into this as little or as much as you're comfortable with. You were diagnosed with cystic fibrosis. Was that after Love Me to Death or during or before?
It was, I think, a month before Love Me to Death was released, but it was after we recorded it.
Wow. No. Okay. Yeah. So can you kind of explain to me a little bit about the diagnosis, what it is, and how you found out what you were feeling to make you go and have the tests?
It's kind of crazy because Joe was the first person I was living in New York part-time, because I was going to college there a few years ago, and I just suddenly started coughing up a lot of blood in the middle of the night. And, it was probably like 3 a.m. in New York. So, I called Joe cause I figured he was on the West Coast. I FaceTimed Joe cause I wanted him to see.
Oh, wow.
I was like something. Yeah. So, I woke up coughing up blood and I thought it was a bloody nose. And anyone who's lived in New York knows like the radiators there in the winter, like it really dries you out. I thought I had a bloody nose. I tasted blood in my mouth and then started coughing it up and couldn't stop coughing it up. And I FaceTimed Joe. I'm not even sure why. I was really freaked out and I didn't know anyone else who would be awake. And he was on the West Coast and
I was the last one you wanted to call, but you had to call him.
Yeah, I was like, that's my only option. He would be awake. And Joe is just like, you need to go to the hospital now.
I almost threw up when I saw
it. He almost threw. He was like, don't show me that. He's like, hang up and call 911.
Yeah, it was a full sink full of blood.
Wow.
It was a lot.
Gnarly.
Oh my God.
It was pretty terrifying. It was really strange. But yeah, it was a full sink of bright, bright blood. And I couldn't stop and I felt like I was choking. So I ended up having to call 911 and I got rushed to the hospital. And at first they thought I had like tuberculosis and they couldn't really figure it out. And I was quarantined. And then, after hours of being in the emergency room, they gave me a Z pack of antibiotics. And I'm like, oh, we think you just have a lung infection. You'll be fine. Oof. And so I went about my merry way. And then about 12 hours later, the same thing happened again. Mm-hmm. And I was with another friend who took me to a better hospital in the city. And, they ran a CAT scan and they also put a camera, a bronchial camera down my lungs and saw that my lungs has a lot of scarring.
Wow.
And they said, this doesn't usually happen with people your age unless they suffer from cystic fibrosis. And I didn't know what that was. So it is a lung disease that you're born with. And usually I think 90% of people are diagnosed as infants. Or newborns really. And yeah, it's strange how it manifests in me. Cause it's, I think the average life expectancy now is 40 and I was diagnosed, really late in life. So it's strange.
Wow, man. So I'm assuming that had an effect on what you do, how you write the music that you make and your outlook on things.
I mean, my outlook on things has always been a little dark, so I'm not sure it could get much darker. I think I was diagnosed probably only 2 months before the rest of my life fell apart. And so I don't even think I had time to really process the diagnosis. I just kind of went into survival mode to get through everything else that was going on and the immediate, my immediate needs and put the diagnosis and whatever it meant on the back burner. And it probably still is to a degree, because I think I've just been focusing on getting back on my feet after going through a divorce, et cetera, and my life being turned upside down. I'm not sure I've even really gotten to really process what the diagnosis means. I just, maybe I'm just still in the denial phase. I don't know.
Look, I'm really thrilled with discovering you really and through Joe, because when he was talking about Joe on when he came on the podcast and you guys were in the middle of doing the Quarantina project, which I just fell in love with. I thought that was incredible. I mean, my favorite video of that whole series is Cluster B. music, but Karay, your performance in that is just amazing.
Which one is that?
That's the one.
There's a lot.
Crying.
Oh, of course, the crying.
Yeah. That is just such an emotional video. It's amazing.
It really is.
Thanks. I feel that project came along, I think, when we both really needed it. And Joe and I had been talking about doing something collaborative, and he sent me the music at first, and then he took it on the path to Quarantina, and it became a film project. And I'm not an actress, so it was something totally different for me. But I trust Joe's vision all the time, and I'm always up for trying stuff. But yeah, that crying scene, I was stressed out about it at first. I didn't think I could do it, but I forgot how well Joe can make me cry. Easily Joe can make me cry. It, probably within seconds. I was like, I don't know if I could cry. And then Joe's like, let's talk about your life.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So yeah, that was fun.
The kid crying was fun. So you've done
a good crier.
Now, in the time between your last album and the Quarantina and the whole pandemic, you've got a lot accomplished. I mean, so you graduated from college with honors. You founded an all-natural skincare line, did your own podcast, Never Meet Your Idols. And at this point, it says you've nearly finished your first collection of sculptural artwork.
Oh, you got you got the press release.
Oh, yeah.
The full press release.
And you've completed an album with Joe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty damn busy.
The easiest part.
We did the album during Quarantina, basically.
Yeah. Okay. It was right on the heels of that.
Wow.
Yeah.
We started even before we were done filming that thing. We started meeting.
Yeah. There was an overlap. I mean, I was there a lot in his studios at his house. So we started on ideas like we recorded, I guess. Yeah, we did record the first song that we recorded.
The first couple. We would do half a day on that and then start.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that makes sense, because a lot of what Quarantina, it looks like it was filmed at night. So
yeah,
you had a lot of free time during the day.
So we'd record during the day and then do Quarantine-ish stuff at night. I mean, Quarantina was like a long project.
Yeah.
So there was an overlap. Yeah. A lot of time together.
It was awesome, though. It was fun as fuck, I thought. We were being productive and just like...
Yeah, we both needed it. It had been a while, I think.
Yeah, that's like the dream, is to be able to like make art with people you care about every day. Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
How fucking lucky can you be? You
know? I think you guys were the most productive people I've ever met during the whole pandemic. That's amazing.
I think our output's pretty... We never struggle in terms of creative output. I think Joe and I are pretty productive when it comes to that. I think we just need to figure out a way to monetize it.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about it.
The challenge.
Well, there's a lot of different styles of music on the album. I mean, I love the first single, I Know Who You Are. Like a 50s, 60s doo-wop sound on The Run. And this was all, again, stream of conscious improvising lyrics. And was Joe coming up with the music and you were doing the lyrics? How was the process with you guys for this one? Was it?
I think this record, actually, of course, Joe's, everything's always, 50-50 between us. But I think this is the record where I can take a lot of the credit for more music than before. I think I've always written music, but I think Joe, we got into like, we inspire each other in a way where Joe usually brought the initial music to the table and I would bring lyrics. This time, I think I like a lot of the last couple records, we both played guitar, but this record, it's mostly me, except for a couple.
I haven't been playing guitar on anything, really.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean,
I've been wanting to touch a guitar for a while.
And I think it just made me rise to the occasion, and it felt really good. It was really empowering to have this record really be a showcase of what I can do. And Joe is always inspires me and supports me and kind of brings out the best in me. But I think I could take a lot of responsibility for the music and in terms of the guitar stuff. But Joe is really great at coming up with beats and synth lines.
I just find the parts that are missing.
You know? Yeah, it's
that's pretty. Really, like what I'm there
and
for.
I think you also like bring out what, you know, when I'm going down a path, he's able to kind of just say, yeah, stick with that, go yeah. with that, you know? So it was, I don't know. I'm really proud of this one. I mean, I'm proud of them all, but this is a departure for me because I finally felt confident enough to really take the lead with the music too.
There's a few songs that sound like they're a little on the nose about the divorce. Is that the case? Like Morning Song
yeah.
and My Biggest Mistake. Oh. Big rock star standing next to me. None of these pussies equal sex to me. He's just another doll licking at my feet. You're stuck in shit, surrounded by these flies. Eager motherfuckers always take your side. You needed a crowd just to feel that you're alright. You're the biggest mistake I made. In a life of regrets, I'd say. Wanna burn down the house we made. Oh yeah. I mean, for sure. That was intense. You know, that was very intentional. I wasn't trying to be poetic on this record. It is pretty fucking straightforward what happened. Yeah.
And it's really the only way I have to reclaiming my voice in a way and setting the story straight. And so I wasn't trying to be coy or beat around the bush. And I think there is something powerful about that. You know, I mean, I always did. I hate when things are too obvious, mm-hmm. but I think this is more just a punch to the throat in a lot of ways. There's no poetic way of saying some of it. Right. I'm not trying to hide anything. You know, it was a very cathartic record because of that.
How did you choose the title, Couples Only?
I went roller skating in a skating rink here, and there was a Couples Only sign. And when I play live shows, there's always a point where I'd play one of the more, you know, the slower kind of ballady songs. And I would jokingly say like, oh, this song is for couples only. But I thought it was funny that this record is a lot about loss and the downside of romanticizing love. And it's a divorce record in a lot of ways. So, I thought it would be funny to call it Couples Only.
Well, one of my favorite songs is actually one of the more touching songs, Stanley R.I.P. Sometimes I find myself still wanting to feel how I felt. When you held me close after we found the dead animal under the house, I would spend nights hoping for earthquakes.
Yeah, that song I wrote while Joe was taking a smoke break, and
it was after the squirrel.
Yeah, and his cat had killed a squirrel. It was really upset about it. So it is. It really is a dead squirrel about a dead squirrel. But it brought out a lot of, obviously it's a really raw song. It brought out a lot of emotions, and you could hear all the birds in the background because the doors were open. So there's a lot of noise in that track because I wrote it while we were on a break. So the studio doors were open and we just left it as is to preserve kind of the visceral aspect of it.
That's exactly the word. That's perfect. It's, and it's one of my favorite songs. That and I Know Who You Are my two favorites on the album. So, and you've got some great guests. You got Roger O'Donnell from The Cure, Christoph Hahn from Swans, who love Swans. Before I get to the socials and how to get the album, because we are running out on time, what does EMDR ATM mean?
We're not allowed to say it.
No? Yeah, I'm not sure. This could be triggering for some people, so I easily offend, I guess.
Nearly had me convinced that I deserve it. Cause I'm a mean bitch. You nearly had me for this. Play a violin, say I'm a mean bitch.
Well, you know, Joe and I, a lot of the time, because a lot of it's most of it, we don't have any idea of what the song's going to be. So when we name a session,
we'll do it like there'll be before there's vocals. There'll be
So we don't know what this song's about.
Okay.
So the title came up because I think EMDR is a trauma. It's a therapy technique for trauma. And I was doing it with my therapist before I went to the studio one day. And Joe was like, what did you do in therapy? What did you talk about in therapy? And I said, oh, I'm doing this thing called EMDR. And I explained to him what it was. And I think he was just like, that's some ass to mouth shit or something. So he said something crude. So we just titled the song we were working on before I even knew what it was about, you know, EMDR, ATM.
That sounds like a perfect way to end this thing.
Yeah, there you go.
So how can people find the album and pre-order it and follow you on social media to find out what you're up to? And
well, it's at Queen Kwong on pretty much all socials. And the record comes out July 12th on a label called Sonic Ritual. There'll be pre-orders for a limited run of vinyls that we're announcing soon. That'll be, I'll announce it through my socials and also through Sonic Ritual. And we have a bunch of singles coming out still beforehand. Two singles are already out. And I think it's available to digitally pre-save on wherever you do that.
I did see that.
So, yeah.
Joe, got just like a minute or two. Do you have anything that you're working on that you want to let us know about? No.
Right. No, I don't know. Yeah, not really. I've been...
You're doing a bunch of music videos.
Yeah, I've been directing a lot of videos, and I'm supposed to do a new album here this year.
Supposed to?
Oh, wait, this is what we should be talking about. We're trying to put together a tour together.
Oh, awesome.
For probably UK and Europe, so we're trying to do that later this year. We need to start talking about that.
The Masters of Disaster Tour.
Oh, yes. Man, that is awesome.
Big bummer.
Well, when that comes out, maybe we'll get you guys both back on. We can get some more details about that.
Yeah. We'll try to sort it out.
Yeah. I hate rushing you guys. I'm so sorry.
No. Thanks for having us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Cameo by the dogs.
Thank you guys so much.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Thanks for the chat.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.